Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for the middle of December. We are only like 30 seconds away from Christmas. Maybe it's like 12 days. So this is our panic edition. I'm just kidding. I don't care enough about Christmas to panic about it. That's also not true.
Yeah, we spent all of Sabbath.
We rearranged.
Panicking over our living room.
Well, we weren't panicking. We were just angry. We rearranged the living room 4 times to make room for the... I'm trying to think of a word that's not a swear word. The tree. It's a very pretty tree. It's like a 12-foot tree or something ridiculous. So now we have to clean the living room.
Yeah.
So we've made room for it. We're not here to talk about that today. We are here to talk about what's wrong with churches that don't meet on Christmas Day, which is a Sunday. And I just want to do a little shout out. There's a great article on Pathos, and everybody should go read it and not leave hate messages, but a very nice fellow writer at Pathos. His church is not meeting on Sunday.
Christmas Sunday.
And he gives some reasons, and we thought in the spirit of Christmas charity and goodwill that we would say why those reasons are wrong. And I will link his article in my post today, so you can go leave him nice comments and messages, because we're not trying to be mean, but we were also casting about for something to talk
about. What's he going to do, and all of our listener
I know.
Comments on his...
He's going to be overwhelmed.
The flood of one listener overflows into...
Okay, the title of his post is Why We're That Church That's Canceling Services on Christmas. And it's by... it's the New Wineskins blog. And it's a great post. So we're being...
What were the reasons that he gave?
We're not being mean. I just want to clarify.
No, we're just trying
constructive
to engagement.
Ginning up controversy. Because we literally have nothing else to talk about. Okay, so the first one is we traditionally give our church the last Sunday of the calendar year off.
So in the reasoning you said, when I'm looking at this thing on your iPad here, the reasoning is that people are busy and they're tired. And so whether Christmas falls on a Sunday or not, they give one Sunday off a year is...
They're volunteer-heavy church, and we don't just have a few key volunteers. We find places for everyone, and everybody works really, really hard on Sundays, and then so to honor them and give them rest and to know that we let them know that we don't take their service for granted, they take the last Sunday of the calendar year off. But in this case, they're going to do it on Christmas because Christmas falls on a Sunday. So they already have a tradition of taking one Sunday off.
Why don't we talk about that?
Yeah. Can you imagine the outrageous joy of Good Shepherd if we announced that they got a Sunday off?
I hopefully people wouldn't be totally joyful about that. But
I don't know. I can hear some rejoicing in the background. It's not happening, guys.
What's the reasoning, though? What's the implicit assumption there that the church is work, for one?
Okay, but that's a good acknowledgement to make. Our church is also work. When people come to church, some people worship God, and other people run their legs off. They're not supposed to do that, but they do. So these people are acknowledging that going to church is work.
I hear that, and I as a pastor, that's the day I work.
That's the only day you work. No, I'm kidding.
That's what people think. People think that you're, as a pastor, you're, you know, invisible 6 days and incomprehensible on
one day.
But Sunday is a work day for me. I don't think of it as. That's my favorite day of the week, and I think some people do like church, maybe. I don't think it's a...
Yeah, I know. I like church.
Okay, right. So you're also one of the ones who works, right?
I work very hard.
But there's something that if church is done right and there actually is the scriptures and the sacraments and the worship, then there's a satisfaction and a contentment and a energizing aspect to it that gives you you strength for the rest of the week when you gather. That's why we're told it encourages you to when you gather with your fellow Christians. That's why Hebrews 10:25 says, you know, do that.
Don't neglect.
Yeah. Don't neglect the gathering together of the saints. Right.
There's a different. So it is work, but this person is saying that because they believe in this, in having a Sabbath, we believe in the Sabbath.
There's a different kind of rest. They shouldn't use that language, first of all, because when you look at the scriptures, the Sabbath, what's commanded of the people in the Sabbath? They don't work, and yet they gather at the temple, at the tabernacle.
Yeah.
And worship.
Which means the choir has to be vested.
Right. Well, the priests work.
Yeah.
They had to get their
offering together. They had to like tie it up.
They have a solemn assembly on the Sabbath, right? So there was worship in the scriptures is not considered work as everything else is. I mean, like the labor in the field or like the labor at your in the smithy or whatever. it's a different category. The work of worship is a rest also.
It's supposed to be.
It's part of the rest, right? When you look at all the feast days in the old covenant, the three major feasts that the Jews celebrated or under the old covenant law, no one was to do any work, and yet males at least, and at least one in the Passover, the families, were to come.
You had to make a journey.
Give sacrifices and offerings, praise God.
It lasted a long time, yeah.
And drink.
Which meant like preparing the food.
Yeah, yeah.
It meant getting everybody to the different, you know, events that were going on. It meant still carrying on with like, you know, probably washing everybody's clothes periodically, feeding the animals.
So there's a kind of thing in the Bible. I think the work of worship is actually rest, and I know it doesn't seem like that often. Like what you say, you sometimes you come home on a Sunday morning after running around like a banshee all day, and you're
it's not
exhausted.
A banshee. I don't
but the cumulative effect of Sunday after Sunday is.
Spiritual health,
right. I think people...
But I don't think in the U.S. we have a good concept of work, and so when you bring in the word Sabbath, I know me personally, you know, when I read Hebrews and it talks about rest in Hebrews, it's very hard for me to understand because work and rest in this culture is muddled. It's kind of confused. So I think that when we talk about rest in the church, we are imposing our other categories from regular life, which is that if you have rest or leisure, it belongs to you. You own it.
Right.
And it's your right. It's some kind of right that you have. And it's a moment for you to, it's like self-care.
So why should I spend my weekend at church?
Yeah, I need to do things that keep me healthy. That means like getting some exercise falls under self-care, eating properly, but also going and getting a pedicure and eating a bar of chocolate falls under self-care, going to the, you know, going out to eat and, you know.
Those are all fine,
but those are kind of like we have ownership over our time. And so when you rest, when you do leisure things that are supposed to be rest, that's part of your birthright.
I think part of the problem in the West is that because of the way the religion of the self that we've kind of developed, there even for Christians, we don't take revelation, God's revelation in the scriptures, not the book of Revelation, but the Bible itself, as the sure and certain guide for what really does give us rest. Right. So we think we know. I think I know what I need to do to make myself feel better.
Yes.
And I'm going to do that. And it doesn't, the Bible might say, hey, you need to gather with the saints. I don't care because I know better. I know better what I need and I'm going to take what I need.
Yeah.
And you end up actually becoming more exhausted the more you focus on self and try to do so in a way that the Bible actually tells us is not helpful.
Yeah.
So the person who's on, you know, it's classic, you know, the college student who thinks he's on quote-unquote vacation by going down to Fort Lauderdale and drinking his guts out and doing all kinds of horrible things, comes back from vacation exhausted.
I've
kind of blown off some steam while he's...
Yeah, now I'm ready for class.
He's exhausted himself and come back with a venereal disease. And so he's
He's all set now.
He's all set, right? Right now, no one does that. But the idea that I know what's best for my body, I know what's best for my mind, I know what's best for my relaxation, and to some extent that's true, but not when that conflicts with what the scriptures say is best for you. And we don't trust that as Christians. Right.
Well, yeah. Overall, we don't because we don't. Well, I think it's not even that we don't trust it because the categories are so.
Right.
We don't have a category of worship, nor a proper category of rest. And the relationship between worship, rest, and work is just completely... Those categories don't exist for the Christian apart from the culture. The culture has already defined them. So that's where you get the word Sabbath. You know, I believe in Sabbath.
Right.
I would say at Good Shepherd, we do struggle with the question of work because people do come into the church and exhaust themselves.
Right.
And that has to be balanced constantly against worship.
Well, there...
So we've had to make some decisions because those categories are confused in mm-hmm. people's minds and they come to church ready to work.
When we got to Good Shepherd, there was a very small... number of people there. No, there wasn't mm-hmm. very, there weren't very many people. And there hadn't been a pastor there for 3 years. Mm-hmm. There'd been interim, but no one else. And so the sense was this church is a place where people come to do their dinners, their work on the building,
and when think we about work money together, and budget. We work together and we get We
That's
have good
what
fellowship.
Forms the bond.
Yeah,
we work together to make. We produce dinners. We do the harvest dinner every year, mm-hmm. and that was the big thing. That was the kind of united
the whole church,
and so when a visitor would come, it was.
You would visit Good Shepherd, and on the very Sunday of your visiting, you could be asked by any number of people to participate in the work of the church, like. We're having a dinner next week. Would you like to come serve at the dinner? Would you like to come and help make the scalloped potatoes for the dinner that we're having next week?
Right.
Or would you like to work in the nursery? Or what work would you like to do? We have all these options of work. Pick something, and then you can become part of our community.
And worship and preaching and teaching, all of that was secondary. Mm-hmm. To the work of the church.
Yes.
That was not the primary thing that the church did together. It was the service, the work, and so that was backwards. That was a work culture that became the community itself became more important than offering anything to God.
Mm-hmm.
And what served to draw the community together, in this case work, was therefore the center.
Yes.
Of everything. And so that can happen in a church that's, you know, getting smaller. You have generations and generations of people have gone there, fewer kids. The tendency is to kind of gather together in this tight little mm-hmm. family bond and that looks inward and not outward mm-hmm. and doesn't look up either.
Yes.
Anyway. So when we got there, you know, I guess I was... we were I was conceived as the guy who was going to come and help.
Organize the work.
Organize the work.
That was your job.
Yeah, I remember that. I mean, the guy, when I was interviewed, one of the major, I think it was a senior warden at the time, said, he looked back at me as we were driving in the car, and I was in the back seat, and he said, "How long do you preach?"
And he said,
12 minutes.
I can preach for 12 minutes.
I can preach for 12 minutes, and I can. And I just won't.
You did like one Sunday.
Yeah, I think I did, yeah.
And it was 15.
Yeah.
So, it's taken a long time. We've been here for 14 years. We have...
One more thing about that before we go on. Is that in that culture, the hardest workers have the most power. So we've never been a wealthy church. Mm-hmm. So in some churches, people use money to wield power. So the guy who donates $20,000 to the Capital campaign has influence, and the guy who donates $5 doesn't. Mm-hmm. And that's wrong, but that's the way sometimes churches that are wealthy work.
Mm-hmm.
And our church was never wealthy, so our currency was how much you get, how much sweat you give. And so the person who is at the church all the time doing the most work has the most influence, and those who give not that much work, they're less. And so and that played into the Good Shepherd Award and all. Oh my gosh. We had something called the Good Shepherd Award.
Describe the Good Shepherd Award.
Okay, so every year there was a committee that would meet and decide who had done the best, who had given the best service to the church. And so they would get the Good Shepherd Award. And there was a plaque in the back of the church with names on it. Right. And so the politicking to be named.
Because the former recipients of the award would be the ones to give the award the next time.
Right.
So it was like a little elite club
of. So in the politicking to be named.
Yep. Was fabulous.
Good Shepherd of the Year, I guess.
Good Shepherd of the Year. I'm the Good Shepherd.
Right. Right. So that was one of the first things you put it into by giving the award to Jesus.
We gave it to Jesus, which was so offensive.
People were angry.
Well, because nobody can get it after
Jesus. Yeah, who's going to succeed Jesus as the next year's Good Shepherd?
I'm sorry, I almost spit tea all over my iPad. Yeah, so I just want to take a little trip down memory lane because I grew up in a school where they would give awards for being like best Christian, most encouraging Christian, most improved Christian.
What is that? Who does that?
I never received any of those awards, so.
I'm shocked, really? I would never have thought, I would have thought that you'd been the first in line. To get all of the awards.
To get an award.
It's piety points. It's
well, yeah, we have.
We joke about getting piety points, but they're
yeah. In our family, we can get piety points and martyr points, but you'd get piety points by being really holy and good, and you get martyr points by being selfless. But if you mention to anyone that you've gotten some points. You lose all your points.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a horrible system.
Right. But that's a kind of a joke. But these, the Good Shepherd Award and the Best Christian of the Year award, that's serious stuff. It's crazy. So yeah, so we had to transform the focus of the church from work to worship, and that took a lot of work.
And what we did was when we came in, we made big speeches to people about how bad they were. And we're joking about it. No, we didn't. We just started having Bible studies and going systematically through the scripture. And we noticed that people didn't want to do work and often still don't. Like, I actually am greatly comforted by the great number of people who come to Good Shepherd.
Who would rather go to Bible studies and sit there listening to the sermon and worship than do any work at all.
You can't get them to go down and work in the nursery because they don't want to miss the sermon. And they're desperate for the sermon, particularly in the... We have a large number of people come to the class, go to groups during the week. And many of them don't do a lick of anything in the church. Which is a great heartbreak to the people who are doing all the work like me, but I prefer it that way.
I think
way.
It'll change. What happened is a while back, so just 5 or 6 years ago, we instituted a new policy, which I think is really helpful for churches, and I would recommend it to anyone, is that, and that is that no one can be in on any kind of service.
In you any can't kind of service. Do anything. You can't barely
no,
even
No,
make
that
the
doesn't mean you can't, like,
you can wipe
clean
up the
after
table
the church or whatever, but you can't be in a ministry.
On Sunday. Yeah.
In an actual ministry. Or any kind of service, long-term service, regularly working ministry, unless you are attending regularly a Bible study, a mission group, which is our small group program, with looking at also focused around the scriptures, or come to Adult Christian Ed on Sunday morning. So one of those three things. If you don't do those things, or, you know, come to church.
No, that includes, like, you have to come to church.
Yeah, you have to come to church too.
And you have to go to one of these other things during the week.
Right. Then you can't serve. And the reason for that is that we were noticing that people would come to church, they would have no discipleship at all. Some of them may not even know Jesus, but they would embed themselves in a ministry and start working, mm-hmm. and they wouldn't have any idea what the gospel is. Mm-hmm. And they would amass power. Through the work that they were doing, and they would wield that power
over
in a way
other
that was
people.
Detrimental to the church and to the gospel.
And the straw that broke the camel's back for you is when you walked into Shepherd's Bowl, which is our soup kitchen, mm-hmm. and heard a very, very lovely person who actually didn't even attend Good Shepherd, really. It's just because sometimes people come in off, you know, from other places and help with that dinner, and a person came up to the window and said, "This is such a great dinner. Why do you do this?" And this person looked at them and said, "I'm just a person who really likes to give and help. I'm just that kind of person.
This makes me feel good."
And you,
I just about tore my hair out.
Yeah,
you're doing this because it makes you feel good. I mean, I'm glad it makes you feel good. Yes.
But that's not why we're doing this
Being
dinner.
Being nice to the nice makes you feel nice. That's a great thing. But that's not why we're serving people. We're serving people because of Jesus. And you and everybody, I want everyone who serves a Good Shepherd to be able to articulate the gospel when asked.
Yeah.
And
why are you here?
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
I don't know. Hey, it makes me feel good. My heart kind of has this warm, strange feeling, you know? And
I get the good feeling I get when I go there.
So you, poor person, are a prop.
For my
feeling good about helping you.
So we
change and also we
so
instituted
we have a new...
you can't even start working until you've been at the church for 6 months being discipled.
Yeah, so these two things where you cannot do anything until you've come for 6 months and you cannot do anything unless until you're in a group or, you know, and regularly in worship. Did cause some...
People left the church.
Yeah, we did lose... We had some people leave.
I had one person slam down their keys and walk out. We were talking and they were kind of had their keys in their hand. And this person was refused. This person told me, "I will not go to a Bible study or a Christian ed or a mission group. And I'm going to continue to do this particular thing that she was doing." And I said, "No, you won't." You're in disobedience to the church, and you're gonna be out. I'll remove you from your position. She slammed down her keys, walked out, and hadn't been back.
Yeah. So there were some consequences.
Yeah. Yeah.
To us, for us, for doing this, initially it was rough, and people were really scared. What's gonna happen? Everybody's gonna leave. You know, the people who believed in this plan that we made. Were anxious. I was anxious. About it.
Well, because what happened when we did is suddenly we had six teams of Shepherd's Bowl workers.
We went down to four. Yeah.
We had
a lot of nursery workers.
We have
barely enough nursery workers.
The work crews went down.
Children's Chapel is always in dire straits.
Right. But it's steadily built back up over time.
It has.
And in the
But I would say we don't have an overall run. Like, we're never overwhelmed with enough people to do things.
Right.
In response to this article, I would say we are not a volunteer heavy church in the sense that there's a ton of work to do and not everybody participates in it.
Right.
On the other hand, I'd say what percentage of people do attend studies And
I would say if you like to be a member of the church, you have to.
Yeah, you have to be in study. So, most people are in.
Yeah.
Worship and Christian ed. They come to worship on Sunday morning. They stay for the whole hour and a half because our service is really long. That's the other thing. Our church service
lasts an hour and a half.
Is very demanding. The sermon is 40 minutes. There's long amounts of music. You have to stand up and sit down. There's no cushions on the pews, which is really deeply troubling to many people.
I agree. We should put cushions.
We should have cushions on the pews. We're not haters, man. So, but the people value that hour and a half. Actually, from 9:15 until 1 o'clock, people are at church, and it's valued so highly that nobody's willing to do anything to interrupt it, like go down and help in the nursery. Well, not. There's a handful of people who help in the nursery. So why is that our, why are we happy?
Well, I think what happened is that God, God's word, is actually true that when you set the scriptures at the center of everything you're doing, then there's strength and there's vitality in a church,
mm-hmm.
and there's energy to do things, and there's that is what bears fruit. Working to work doesn't.
Yeah.
Having Christ's word bring us to maturity. Allowing Christ's word to do its work actually is what brings the church to greater maturity and
right. So the people who are doing stuff, who are working hard, are not. They may be tired, but they're not exhausted. They're not devoured by right. other people. They're able to say no when they need to.
Yep.
They have. They're being fed in the scriptures, and so they're not building out little kingdoms for themselves in their ministries.
It weeds out the temptation to use work as a power,
yeah.
power base. It's no longer. You
don't get
work is no credit. Longer. Yeah, the what it used to be. You don't get your name on a golden plaque, and so there's not the and you don't wield the influence you used to as a
person who works.
Right.
So. And yet we still are. So we're always looking for people to do things, but we have to constantly say no. Oh, I would have loved for you to do this, but
since you're not doing this, you can't do that.
You haven't been to church in a really long time, so
yeah.
I can't use you. I'm really sorry. That makes me really sad. And so we haven't done some things. We've actually pared down. There's some things that we don't do,
right?
Because we don't have people to do them, which is a really great thing.
Yeah.
My favorite thing about the church, actually.
Right. Another thing.
We could even pare back more.
Right. Which is, kind of interesting. Another thing this person mentioned in his article was that the church isn't brick and mortar.
Yeah.
That phrase always is one of the pet peeves of mine. Well, the church is a brick and mortar. As if anyone says that it is. I don't know any, at least from within the Protestant realm, who thinks that the church really is a building. Of course, the church is the people. And I think his argument was, well, because it's not brick and mortar, we don't have to meet in the brick and mortar place. Is that what he was saying?
Yeah, it means that if you want to meet... okay, because it is a tradition and not a biblical mandate to meet every single Sunday morning... we're not going to guilt our church into showing up 12 hours after Christmas Eve services for another round. Okay, that was something else.
We'll come back to that because I want to address that, but go ahead.
I'm looking for the brick and mortar. This was in the section about the family, which we probably all also want to talk about, that the idol in this scenario, the family... or a worship service held in a brick-and-mortar building. He's setting up these two things because people have been talking about the idolatry of the family. And so he's saying, well, what about the idolatry of the brick-and-mortar building? The family was instituted first by God, not the brick and mortar building. So we need to allow people more space for family.
Okay, that's both a false dichotomy and a straw man. So the false dichotomy between family and church is the first problem. Yes, God did institute the family first, but when he made Adam and Eve, but the garden was a temple. it was a place.
So they were in a place of worship.
Exactly, in communion with God, and and the whole of the New Testament is a recreation of, or whole of the scriptures is a recreation of a meeting place between God and man.
Yeah.
And beginning with the tabernacle and then ending with Christ and his church.
Right.
So it's a false dichotomy.
Families are
right.
pictures
and that. And whenever you have Christ confronting the question of the relationship between family and himself,
he
always says okay. The family comes second.
Yeah.
After, not just himself, but the assembling of the people who are with him.
Yeah.
Because he looks around when his mother and his brothers are out coming to get him. And he looks around at those seated around him as he is teaching them and says, this is my family.
Mm-hmm.
These are my people.
Mm-hmm.
And what on earth, what gives us any license to treat our brothers and sisters in Christ and the gathering together of those brothers and sisters as something less than the nuclear family? No, that doesn't happen. Our family is the church. Of course, there are nuclear families within the church. Of course, you have responsibilities toward them, as we're all through the scriptures. But the priority is the gathering of those who know and love Jesus, and then the straw man was the brick and mortar that just drives me up the wall. I mean, go worship outside in a tent with your buddies if you want to, or just worship in the rain and the snow if you want to. But the fact that the church meets in a building is not a bad thing. I mean, is
at least
it somehow,
where we live.
No, I mean,
if we didn't have a building,
I don't understand that. Is a building a sacrilege? I mean, we don't think it's the temple. We don't think it's but it is the place where the church gathers together, and so that's a good thing. We have it's a convenient and helpful thing to have a building where people meet. And taking care of that building is okay. It's not a bad thing to do. What on earth?
Well, don't be so
I'm sorry.
Sarcastic.
It makes me...
Because lots and lots of people...
Well, the straw man is, well, you're putting this building as an idol. And blah, 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 blah. We don't do that because we don't have idols in our church. In our gathering of people who never meet in a building. What? I think it's a strain of reactionary, maybe Anabaptist way of thinking about the institutionalized church, the building becomes the enemy, and when the building becomes the and not just the building, it's the anything that smacks of traditional churchy things becomes in the mind of the reactionary an idol.
Yeah.
And in fact, what's happened is, he's most of the people I've met like that have also created little idols, out of their own perceptions of what the church should be, which is generally, people who talk like that love house churches and love, they'll say something like, well, I can get together with my friend on Tuesday and drink coffee at Starbucks, and where two or more are gathered, there Jesus is, and that's the church. No, it's not.
Well, or what about the idea that the worship portion of the service is, well, first of all, that the whole service isn't worship, but that the music portion is worship. So if you've done a certain set of choruses, then you have worshiped, and then you're ready for the sermon, as if the whole thing isn't...
It's all worship.
So you can sort of divide out different sections of what's going on and refer to it as worship or not. I think you're not really talking about what is actually happening when people gather on Sunday.
The visible manifestation of the invisible church happens when the word of God is rightly preached, the communion is rightly instituted, and there's discipline in the church. There's three marks. There's three marks that, that tell you that there is, in fact, a legitimate church. And when the people of God gather, Christ promises to be present. He promises to use his word to preach, to mature the body, right? the gathered body. Mm-hmm. And that's all in 2 Timothy 3 and 4. And then when the sacrament of communion is given, we are partaking, we're told in 1 Corinthians 11, of the body and blood of Christ. That doesn't happen at Starbucks. You can't do that at Starbucks. Right. Well, unless you clear the table off and get the whole church there and have someone go through the Eucharistic prayer and have
and some coffee, which is not cool.
Right. But there's no when two or more Christians gather, they're not feeding on, they're not partaking in the body and blood of Christ. That happens at communion. It doesn't happen at.
So I don't think you have to set the family in opposition to the church.
No,
like, it's not. It's not wrong to encourage whole families to come to church and participate in the whole life of the church year. I mean, children are formed in a really important way when you bring them to celebrations. I guess I don't understand why, family time is so important on Christmas morning. And so you just give everybody.
Yeah, again, it's a false dichotomy. They're pitting two things against each other that don't need to be pit against each other.
I would say just nobody comes to our Christmas Day service.
No, it's very low.
Like 20 people.
We're going to have very small turnout, but it's a, you don't
most cancel. People do come on Christmas Eve because that is the main service, but then we do have a service on Christmas Day if you want to come. It's later in the morning.
But the idea of canceling a Christmas Day service on a Sunday because it's a Sunday and you give a Sunday off to your people is...
Yeah.
That's... can we go back to this idea of it being a tradition that we don't need to follow? And
yeah, let me go find that section. So, traditions aren't necessarily a bad thing as long as they don't become everything. Traditions are meant to serve you, not strangle you. We give our folks, is this the part you want? A Sunday off because we believe in the Sabbath.
Okay, which we've already said that part is...
But the question
is a misunderstanding of what the Sabbath is.
Okay, because it's a tradition, not a biblical mandate to meet every single Sunday morning. That would be awkward for all the Sunday night services.
It's a tradition that we meet on Sunday.
We're not going to guilt our church into showing up 12 hours after the Christmas Eve service for another round. We're not going to do that either.
Okay. It's a tradition that it's a tradition. He says we meet on Sunday. However, let's trace that tradition. Let's see where that goes. In 1 Corinthians chapter 16, and in Acts 20, it seems that on the first day of the week, in the apostolic era, the mm-hmm. church is already meeting.
Yeah.
And that's when Paul tells the Corinthians to gather their offerings together and collect them for the time when he comes so he can take them to Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be the time when the church that he in Troas is meeting, and the guy falls out of the
window.
the window. That was a long church service.
And, well, they were meeting at night. He was tired.
Right, and it seems to be that's the idea. And the term the Lord's Day seems to have already been attached to Sunday by the apostolic era. Mm-hmm. You see that term specifically used in Revelation chapter 1. And most believe that was a reference to Sunday, because the Lord's Day, because that's the day that the Lord rose
from the dead.
And so the idea that this is a tradition, it's an apostolic tradition. It goes back to the apostles. It's true, there's no there's no direct command saying you must meet on a Sunday. That's absolutely true.
Do not neglect the assembling of the...
But when you, if you belong to a church that meets on Sunday, you need to go on Sunday, because that's right, because Hebrews chapter 10, verse 25, command, it's a command. Do not neglect the gathering together of the body of the saints. So there's good reason to meet on Sunday. I think it's the best day to meet because of the resurrection and the fact that the Holy Spirit was indwelt the church on a Sunday. Those are important moments.
They were kind of a big deal.
Those are big things, you know. Yeah, yeah. So I think it's a good thing to meet on a Sunday. It's not a law, but it's a good thing to meet on a Sunday. And the weekly gathering, I think, is pretty much assumed, at least in the New Testament, a weekly gathering. I mean, in the beginning of the church in Acts 2, they're meeting every day. But it does seem that by the time we get to, you know, Paul's letters, they're meeting once a week, and that day seems to be Sunday. So you deciding to just chuck all that because it's not commanded is a little bit. It's taking what you consider freedom and misusing it.
Also, I think there's a, I mean, I do, I think there's a little battle that goes on every Sunday. First of all, in our lives, we're really desperate for people to come to church. Like, we don't really have the luxury of, picking and choosing or, you know, wanting people to not come or not caring.
Mm-hmm.
We really are so grateful for every single person who comes to church every Sunday or any Sunday, and are so grateful when people decide to come, you know, and make Good Shepherd their home. But every Sunday that I'm in the building, there's a palpable sense that there's a mighty war going on. And a mighty spiritual war, because there are so many things in the world that are drawing people away from Jesus at, you know, and on every level. And it's kind of gathered up and representative on Sunday. It's like a Sunday is kind of a symbol for not the commitments of people, but for all the things that draw a person away from God. And when you make it to church, and you're there with other Christians, and you get your kids there, and you show up, you know, at whatever time in the middle of the sermon with your coffee, whatever you got there, there is so much rejoicing, I think, not just from you and me, but from all the heavenly hosts. I think that God in heaven and the angels rejoice
mm-hmm.
when a person becomes Christian, but when that person shows up in church and gets into a pew and joins in, there is it's something essential in the world has been overturned.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a triumph. And when that happens every Sunday, that just builds and builds the in the hearts of the, it strengthens right. the body. And so it's not that you should feel really guilty when you don't make it to church, although
yes, you
that's
should.
Fine if you want to feel guilty. Well, but
confess it. It's a sin.
But you should.
And if you can go and you don't go, that's a sin.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and agree with you there.
Hebrews chapter 10, verse 25. If you can go to church,
you don't go, it's a sin. But when you do go, and you struggled because it was so hard to get there, it was, you know, you would have had every possible excuse not to go because it was horrible and difficult to get there. You should rejoice. You should celebrate the fact that you got it. You got there. And you should enjoy the day. And talk to people and eat a donut and reward yourself whatever it takes.
Yeah.
Because the power of Satan was in an imperceptible way overturned when you did that. And yeah. I think the church should help, should be, you know, we should rejoice with each other. We should be happy to be there. And we shouldn't cancel it, even on the last Sunday of the year, as a gift, as a thank you to all the people who work so hard. I think the symbolism of that really makes, turns it around into the chore that it feels like, rather than acknowledging that it is in fact not a chore. A battle is being fought. And you took up sides and
got to church.
You got to church with your, you know, and that.
That's great. I totally agree with that.
And I know that it's a battle, you know, we have to be there. It's our job, and yet the battle just to get out of the door on Sunday morning with everybody dressed and the car started and get there on time and does the sermon print and did the coffee maker stop working. And, you know, yesterday, speaking of our car, I was supposed to go get somebody and my car froze shut and I couldn't go get her. And I had to run around and somebody else got her. Somebody's tire went flat on her way into the parking lot. And one family had a whole gallon of orange juice split open as they were trying to leave, and they had to stop and clean it up. And anybody, any normal person under those circumstances would say, you know what? I'm done. I'm not going.
Yep.
My entire house is covered in sugar. I'm done. I'm not going. But they got there. They eventually got there. Somebody else, oh no, two people were locked out of their houses yesterday. Huh. Two separate people. And all those people overcame those, you know, extreme irritations and horridness in order to come to church, because it was important well, you and I know there.
when if there's a night of the week we don't sleep, it's Saturday.
It's Saturday.
If something goes wrong, it's going to be Saturday.
It's Saturday.
Yeah, right.
Because Sunday matters.
And Satan hates it. Satan hates Sunday.
He wants you to. So you should just to spite Satan, just for sheer orneriness, you should get up and go just because it makes him angry. And I think that that sense, when you accommodate, when you make every accommodation of the culture, you lose the you miss out on the incredible battle that's going on between, not between God and Satan, Satan trying to usurp God and not being able to.
And use you to do it.
Yeah.
Wow, we've gone on for 50 minutes.
Oh my gosh. We were going to talk about Joseph because we got a question from our listener.
Yeah, about Joseph,
And how, what a great guy he is. But you know, that would be a great thing to talk about next week.
Yeah, because we can do, we can have a special Christmas edition.
We'll have a special Christmas edition.
Next week.
We talk about
Joseph,
how Joseph
the
is
incarnation,
one of the best guys ever.
Mary.
Mary, yeah. Oh yeah, we could talk about Mary because that's not controversial at all.
Right.
We could offend our Catholic listener.
Roman Catholic.
Our Roman Catholic. Okay, I do. We have stuff that we've got to do. So,
okay,
thank you so much for listening.
Oh, and by the way, your book came out.
Oh, yeah, I wrote a book.
Yeah, and it was published.
It's published. It's available on Amazon.
Yeah, it's available on Amazon. And you were featured as one of the 21 worthy gifts, book gifts, to be
in Christianity
to give in this year in Christianity Today.
Yeah.
Thanks to Karen Swallow Pryor.
So,
who wrote up the nice little recommendation for
I was going I wanted to like give her a present, but I didn't know what to give because giving her my own book would kind of stink. So maybe I'll get a book from that list.
Well, she already read it because she also
she already read it. So maybe I'll get her a book off that list.
Yeah, that was very sweet of her. Yeah.
So yeah, read my book. Hashtag nailed it.
More importantly, buy
the book. Don't have to read it.
Buy more copies of the book.
Just buy
it. Read it, and instead of reading the same book again, buy it again. Because you know there's nothing more irritating than reading a book that you've already read before. So so buy it a second time and read a new book again.
That's absurd.
I know.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Bye-bye.